Okay, good morning. We're rapidly drawing to the end of the Megillah, which we've been studying now for approximately 6 months. It just shows how something which we think we know, and that's one of the beauties of studying Torah, is that we rediscover it. What we did last week, well, let me backtrack. Let me just, because we have people joining us who may not have heard the whole approach. One of the basic approaches to Megillat Esther, which everybody has adopted over the years, and it's one of the things I try to avoid, be honest, is the whole what I call the rabbinic approach. And the rabbinic approach is basically to see Esther, Mordechai, the quintessential Jewish heroes, right? Which is fine, you know, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with this, but it's an approach which, you know, has been, I don't know how to describe it. It's one of those things that you hear, and rabbis talk about this every year when it comes to Purim and sort of the lessons to be learned. It's all fine and good. But what I was determined to do, and I hope it's come across in the lectures that we've been having had so far, is to give you a contra approach, something which is slightly different. And the point which I'm trying to raise is essentially what I call midrashic approach, but a different type of midrash. Midrash is something where you can apply different analysis, right? Midrash does this. Midrash says that, you know, one opinion says it was X, one opinion says it was Y, you know, the tree in the Garden of Eden. One just had it in the Daf Yomi. One opinion says it was a fig tree, one opinion says it was a date tree, one says it was a etrog, one says it was a something else. You know, all the different opinions which exist on the story, which we always thought was one way, it turns out that there's a whole rabbinic universe out there of different ideas. And what I've done is basically looked around and I found a commentary from a very contemporary rabbi in Israel, Benny Lau, whose uncle was the famous Chief Rabbi Lau, who's still amazingly, 100% with the program. What a wonderful speaker, if you ever get a chance to hear him. He speaks beautifully in English as well as in Hebrew. He really is an amazing man. A survivor of Buchenwald, right? Him and his brother. They survived, they were children. You have to read the book. If you haven't read his book, it's a must. Out of the Depths. It's a phenomenal book. So basically, what Rav Lau, Benny Lau, has done is given what he calls a more historical, kind of different type of midrashic approach. And what we've discovered is that we, and again, just a bit of framework before we go into our points for today, is that at the beginning of the story of Purim, we're dealing with a community in Shushan that could very well have been a totally assimilated community. All right, this was the suggestion we made right from the beginning. We're not dealing with a community like we have today, where you have a percentage of religious, a percentage of what we call conservadox or conservative, and then we have people who are non-orthodox and all the rest of it. There, the whole community had gone into a situation where they were comfortable to the point of becoming part of the fabric of Persian society. They had assimilated. And believe it or not, there is a strong suggestion that Mordechai and Esther were also part of the assimilation. Why do we say that? There's one thing that we've suggested, a number of reasons. We've always understood Mordechai was located in the palace. Right, so everybody says, yeah, because, you know, being the chief rabbi or whatever, he had to be in the palace. But that would be a strange arrangement in Persia. Something that we can understand in Washington, you have to have, you know, advisors to the president when it comes to things about Judaism. But in Persia, maybe not so much. So you know what? It could be that Mordechai was, in fact, very high up in the Persian government. And we actually explain this, that Mordechai may very well have been, as the Midrash actually says, he was a general in the Persian army. And he was at the battle, I speculate, but there's a number of battles that we know in history that the Persian army fought. One of them was the Battle of Marathon, the year 490 BCE. And it's very likely that Mordechai was there, right? And not only that, not only he was there, but Haman was there. So we're talking about people. I mean, Mordechai, being a general in the Persian army, was not a, what they call in Israel today, Rav Tzva'i. He wasn't a rabbinic representative in the Persian army, I assure you. What he was doing there was a general. He was very high up in Persian society. So basically, what we try to understand is that the story of Purim at the beginning reflects a Jewish community which is very assimilated. And Mordechai, even by his name, right? We always think Mordechai is a good Jewish name. It turns out that it's a good Persian name. Okay, you know, very often you have names which have been adopted by the Jewish community. Alexander. Alexander is a good Greek name, right? The fact that it's become Jewish is because everybody liked the stories of Alexander the Great, and he had respect for the Kohen Gadol. There's a whole story with him. And the reality is that these names get adopted. So Mordechai is Marduk, is one of the gods of Persia. Esther, which again, she has a good Hebrew name, Hadassah. But she's never called Hadassah. We don't know her as Hadassah. We know her as Esther. Esther is the name given by the Persians to the god of the moon, I think it is. Astarte, if I'm not mistaken. In which case, we're talking about two people who have very, let's be very blunt about it, very secular descriptions which are given at the beginning of the story. And what we try to suggest from the beginning of the story is that part of the issue of the story of Purim is that the community in Persia, which was in exile from Israel, remember, the temple was destroyed in 586, and now the permission had been given by Cyrus, the Persian emperor, to go back to Israel. This is all in the book of Ezra. And the initial move back to Israel did not happen. The Jews, for a year or two, heard the decree. A few of them, what we call chalutzim, like in the 1920s, they went to live in the swamps and whatever. The reality of most people was it was too comfortable in Persia. They stayed behind and they didn't go. And the story of Purim takes place between the announcement of Cyrus, which is in 539, 538 BCE, and the eventual return of the Jewish community to Israel when the second temple is finally built, which is much further ahead, around the year 470. So in between those two dates, there's about 60, 65 years when the Jewish community in Persia seems to be very disconnected from Eretz Israel. And as a consequence of their disconnect, a lot of the events of Purim take place. Right? You see that, for instance, the whole question of the meal at the beginning. They go to this very big celebration, which we explained. There were two meals, right, and all the diplomacy that was going on. And again, the reality seems to be that at the beginning, there was no issue for them to go to the meal. They certainly did not have a mashgiach at this meal, I can assure you. According to rabbinic tradition, it was part of the reason why they were in such danger, because they had been part of that celebration, that meal, which they shouldn't have gone to. All right, and the rabbis say, and of course there's a whole discussion about how you link one thing to the other. I mean, but again, we've spoken about this already before, but I want to give the sort of picture. The interesting thing is that Mordechai and Esther, through the story of Purim, become heroes. And what happened to them? They were the people that in the end of the day had to stand up for the Jewish community. If they did not stand up for their community, then they were done. They were gone. Right, remember, Haman comes along and he is the descendant of Amalek, and he represents everything that we understand. We've got it happening again today. We still have Amalekites running around the world, right? It's things that are very disturbing, but they are going on. And the Rabbi Soloveitchik, the famous rabbi of Yeshiva University, argued that Amalek today, the anti-Semite of the 21st century, or he said the 20th century, is the Amalek from the ancient world. May not be the tribe, but certainly has all the characteristics of Amalek. Hasn't gone away. And probably will never go away, right? It's one of the major things that we have to live with. But the interesting thing is that in the story of Purim, the reality of what happened with Mordechai and Esther is that they stood up for the Jewish community. They were in positions of influence, Esther being the queen, Mordechai being very high up in the Persian government, right? That's what we're suggesting. And the time came when, I know you may not necessarily be a community which is based on religious commitment, but you're certainly a community which has Jewish identity. And Jewish identity was under attack. In fact, not just identity, Jewish existence was under attack. if Haman's plan had come to fruition, then every Jew in the Persian Empire would have been killed. And that would have led to who knows what repercussions, and it's all pretty dire, pretty terrible. But what is so fascinating is that Mordechai and Esther go through a change. They themselves become committed to the survival of the Jewish people. And that we saw already back in chapter 4, and we then see it, of course, as it develops through the story. Esther, we saw, invites Haman and Mordechai, Haman and Ahasuerus to one meal, then to a second meal, and all of the story that we saw till then. And of course, by the time we get to where we're up to, chapter 8, which we've already read, but there's a few things I still want to deal with, the reality of it is that the clear and present danger of Haman himself is gone. He's been hanged. He's out of it. But what was set in motion, and this is what we're going to deal with today, the letters. There was a letter sent out by the king. And the letter said, and sealed by the king, and on the instigation of Haman, which said, in no uncertain terms, be ready. They sent it out in Nisan, and they gave 12 months, essentially, for the world to be ready, that there'll be a moment, there'll be a time in the future when you will be able to do what we tell you to do. It's all very vague. All right, it was all very vague. The king's letter, the rabbis explained, was initially quite vague. It told people, be ready to go into action against people who live amongst you in 12 months' time. Now again, we spoke about the delays and all the rest, and we're going to go over that again. But the reality of it is that what is fascinating is the situation which we're up to now. When Queen Esther, in chapter 8 of the story, goes back to the king and says, listen, we've got a big problem. And the big problem is that letter that Haman sent out, and you stamped it, you rubber stamped it, or you sealed it with your ring, that letter is still in existence, right? We spoke about this last week. So if we send out a letter now to say, don't kill the people or don't kill the Jews, what are people going to do? They had a letter which came a few weeks ago, a few months ago, saying, you've got to be ready to kill. Now it's saying, don't kill. People will be confused. They won't know what to do. Do we attack the Jewish community? Do we not attack the Jewish community? What do we do? And at this point, Esther goes to Ahasuerus, goes to the king. We're calling him in his Greek name, Xerxes. And she goes to him and she says, we need to do something to save my people. Now it's all up front. We know who she is. We know who Mordechai is. Everything is now revealed. But the king says, we've got a problem. How are we going to deal with the whole situation of the decree which was made? And the rule in Persia was, once a decree is made, that's it. Done. Very, very interesting analysis here from someone called the Ralbag. We'll see in a minute what he says. On the basis of this story, the king says, well, I'm going to issue a second decree, and the decree will go out. And we saw this was chapter 8 that we read last week. And eventually, of course, we know that the decree was going to reverse the first decree. But of course, the question will be, what were the mechanics? How did it actually work? If the people are holding two letters in their hand, one saying, kill the Jews, or be ready to do something of that nature, and then another letter comes and says, don't do it, what makes the people believe letter B and not letter A? And that's going to be something we're going to talk about today, which we didn't get to last week. And in fact, Mordechai puts it even more intense in terms of the second letter that was sent out. Not only do the Jews are allowed to defend themselves, but they actually can take the initiative and kill their enemies. And that's something which we ask the question, why did Mordechai put into the fashion, the second letter that went out, making it so much more aggressive than it needed to be? You know what it could have said? It could have said that the first letter said that there's going to be attack against the community, essentially understood, Haman explained, this is attack against the Jewish community. And the second letter that would have gone out would have said the Jews can take up arms and defend themselves. And as simple as that. But what did the second letter actually say? And we read it last week, that they can go and kill their enemies. So we started to explain that the second letter is a concept which we know, it's a famous, it's almost a cliche, that the best form of defense is offense. All right? How do you defend yourself? By becoming stronger than the other person by carrying out the preemptive strike, the offense. Right? Six-day war. What happened in the Six-day war? Israel was in such great danger. That first day of the war, when all the news came out, which was so false, that was really fake news. If you think back to that first day of the Six-day war, if you remember it, when all the news came out that the Israeli Air Force had been destroyed, God forbid, and what happened was, in fact, the Egyptian Air Force had been destroyed. All right? So what the Israelis had to do is some form of offense as a form of defense. Otherwise, the whole war would have gone in a completely different direction, as we know. So this is something which we have to explain, maybe in a bit more detail. What was Mordechai's logic, his rationale, when the second letter was sent, where he put into the letter the concept not just of the Jews defending themselves, but actually going out of their way to attack their enemies? And remember, the enemy has the status of a Molech. There is a mitzvah in the Torah, we're going to read it, Shabbat before Purim, the famous Shabbat of Parshat Zachor, to remember what Amalek did to us, the unprovoked attack against the Jewish people when they came out of Egypt, what Amalek stands for, which is the concept of Mikra. Mikra means everything is by chance, they don't believe in God, they don't believe in a concept in any sort of structure in the world. Amalek is essentially the focus of what we today really would call the anti-Semitism in the world that we experience today. Comes from, and always has come from, Amalek in one way or another. It's interesting, again, I don't have the book with me, I was looking for it this morning. Rabbi Soloveitchik, in the famous book he wrote, Kol Dodi Dofek, when the Rav, in the 40s and 50s, when the State of Israel came about, he completely changed his political views. And he started off, really came from Lithuania, he was belonged to the Agudat Israel, which was pretty anti-Zionist. There's no sort of other way to describe it. And what happened was, in the 40s and 50s, after the establishment of the State of Israel, the Rav became very pro-Mizrahi, pro-Zionist, changed his whole idea. And he saw that the birth of the State of Israel was in fact the beginning of the Messianic redemption, and everything that we've sort of associated with the State of Israel to this very day. And it's fascinating, when he writes in his book, he writes about Amalek. And he says there's no question in his mind that today the enemy of the Jewish people, whoever he or she is to be classified as Amalekite. There's no discussion and no deviation from that concept. Very, very interesting thing that he writes. And again, what we see in the story of Purim is the quintessential battle between the Jewish people and Amalek, right? As represented by Mordechai and Esther against Haman, which represents, go back in history, Mordechai is descended from King Saul. King Saul had a battle against the Amalekites, which he almost completely wiped them out, but didn't quite finish the job. And therefore, what's going on here is that Esther and Mordechai, in their situation here, are almost what we call doing a tikkun, trying to repair what King Saul had failed to do. So the whole historical continuation here in the story of Purim is really from the days of King Saul, if not from earlier. So I want that to, again, to be understood, the kind of framework in which we're in. We're going to deal today essentially with two points, and then try and look a little bit at chapter 9. Point number one was this whole plan of the second decree. What was going on and why was it made in such a way? Why did Mordechai sort of make it supercharged against the enemies of the Jews? And what we mentioned last week, which is very intriguing, is the whole item at the end of chapter 8 that the non-Jews converted. They started converting to Judaism. And that in itself is very strange. And the reason why it's so strange is because there are certain periods in Jewish history when you can't accept people who convert. Today, conversion in Israel is one of the biggest and most controversial items that the rabbinate has to deal with, and it's not easy. There are periods in Jewish history when it was understood that you can't accept converts. And the basic reason is because we understand that people were converting not for the right reasons. They were converting because they were afraid. They knew that the Jews were going to attack their enemies. So what do? If you are in such a situation where your life is threatened and the only way to get out of it, they think, is to become Jewish, they apply. They send in the form. Right? I want to become Jewish. So at that point, the question is, were they accepted as converts or not? And you'll see there is an interesting debate. Some say this is the reason why we dress up on Purim. Because people started trying to look different. right? They tried to put on the what they would nowadays say the Jewish clothing, the hat, the jacket, and the whole works. In the equivalent in Persia, I don't know what it was, but presumably some sort of distinctive dress. And as a consequence, they tried to convert. So that's something that we mentioned last week, and I just want to deal with it very briefly today, and set the scene for chapter 9, which I think we'll hopefully get through in the main next week. There's one or two introductory remarks about that. So with this introduction, the way it is, let's have a look at the page I gave you. And I just want to look at the section which starts on the bottom on the right-hand side on page 1. And it's taken from chapter 8, what we read last week. And a little bit of commentary, because it really is very fascinating. So you look at the page 1 that I have in front of you. This is from the commentary of a rabbi who was teaching in Israel until 1996. Passed away in 96. He taught in many of the colleges in Israel, taught in Michlala, he may have taught in the Hebrew University as well. Name was Rabbi Yeshua Bachrach, one of the real great Bible teachers in Israel, a contemporary of Nechama Leibovitz and people like that. Look at part section on the right-hand side at the bottom, where we set up the question of the second decree. Right? I think we all know the story, but there is, as I've said here at the top of the page, a legal quandary. How are we going to deal with the new decree? Why are we going to believe the new one more than the old one? So listen to this. It's the psukim, what we read last week, but we'll go over that very quickly. The king responds to Esther and Mordechai. First thing he announces is, and this we saw from the beginning of chapter 8, is that Esther has taken over the house of Haman, all the property. Haman's property has been sequestered by Esther, Mordechai, and the command of the king. And he's been hanged because he wanted to attack the Jews, and he was executed. Now, says the king to Mordechai and Esther, V'atem kitvu al yudim katov beinechem, write what is good in your eyes, in other words, what you feel is appropriate, b'shem ha-melech v'chitmo b'tat b'tabat ha-melech, and seal it with the seal of the king, once it goes out with the seal of the king, everything is fine. But of course the problem is there's already a letter with the seal of the king, which the king allowed Haman to put together, and that letter said, kill the Jews. So even though the king's original statement, the permission he gave, was a very generic kind of statement, be ready in 12 months' time to do what we tell you to do, Haman made it very clear when he sent it out on behalf of the king that it was a commission of essentially all the anti-Semites to go and kill their Jewish neighbors. So at this point, the king is saying to Mordechai and Esther, send out letter number 2. And how is letter number 2 going to work against letter number 1? Right, we spoke about this, we mentioned this last week. Listen to that, there's such a brilliant suggestion here. Two brilliant suggestions. It's the second column, column B. And I'll read it to you, I'll read it through, and again, if you're not following the Hebrew, just listen, because it's worth listening to what this rabbi says. Et ha-mishpat acharon ki katav asher nichtav b'shem ha-melech. When we just pointed out that whatever the king writes is to be followed, Yesh lahavin, we have to understand, ki kavanato shel al hakatav shel Haman. It's referring to the letter of Haman. That the first letter that came out stood as a command to go and kill the Jews, signed by the king, instigated by Haman. And now a second letter has to go out. This is column B. V'zeh nimuk, and now we have to understand, madua hem tzrichim lichtov svarim acherim. Why do you have to write a second letter? Lefichach ha'iyah agro, the Vilna Gaon explains, she'achashverosh ha'iyah mitareg lomar zot l'Ester levada, ki hi tatchil livkod. He was worried that Esther, if he doesn't explain what to do, she'll start crying again. You know, Esther is very good turning on the waterworks. So she turned it on, and the king did not want her to break down into tears. L'chein omar zot b'nochuto she Mordechai yudi. So he made sure, when he told them what to do, the second letter, make sure Mordechai is there, together with Esther, that they can, you know, he can help her and overcome her emotional request. But listen to this. This is where it gets really interesting. He says, Avah, Mimivneh haperek, the way that the chapter is made, efshar gam lachshov, we can think, ki kavanotosha al hakatav hachadash amar lahem, lichtov b'shem hamelech tom b'tabat hamelech. Now, in other words, when the king says this letter is not to be rejected, when he's just said in what we read at the bottom of the page, it's referring to the new letter, not just to Haman's letter, but now the new letter can be put into action. No, we can't go against the new letter. But mikan onuroim vuchato shel avdan cheskato malchutit she'ein hu to'er le'olam. The problem is Achashverosh himself is in a quandary over here, because it shows that he made a mistake. We're showing that on the one hand he commissioned a letter which went out, and Haman sent it out to kill the Jews, and now he's sending a second letter which is going out to say, don't kill the Jews. So the people who are living in the 127 countries will turn around and say that Achashverosh, the emperor, has, for all intents and purposes, lost his marbles. What's going on? Has he said, do we do it? Do we kill them? We don't kill them. You know, he's giving us signals which we can't understand. And he says, Ki le'ezer mishnei ktavim yamin ha'am l'rishna l'acharon. What are people going to believe? The first letter or the second letter? And this is so interesting. As I said last week, we get to a point in the Megillah, when Haman is hanged, and we don't have many more, you know, times when we can sort of rattle the Gregors and all the rest of it against Haman, we sort of wind down. We don't think about the issues at the end of the Megillah, but there's massive issues at the end. And this is one of them. How did the second decree cancel the first? In Persia, the rule was, when a decree is made, it can never be cancelled. So the second decree comes out that the Jews are in a position where they will be able to attack their enemies. How is that going to cancel the first decree, which was given the permission by the king to Haman to send, where it says clearly you can attack the Jews? It's as if the king is sending a kind of mixed, well, not kind, an absolute mixed message to his people. And he says, Rashi matkinad adavar bezrata pasuka kodem. Rashi has a suggestion that the second letter not only says that the Jews can defend themselves, but it also mentions what it says in the verse over here, that Esther has taken over the house of Haman. If Esther has taken over the house of Haman, then that is a sign that who is in favor? Esther. Who is out of favor? Haman. So therefore, if the king is now writing that the Jews can defend themselves, people will say, well, the first letter came from Haman, but he's out of favor. Why is he out of favor? Because all of his property, without dealing with the death of Haman himself, but everything has gone over to Esther. So therefore, because of that, Rashi says that's why they would believe letter number two and not letter number one. I hope that's clear. I hope that makes sense. Letter number two would be mentioning not only should you allow the Jews to defend themselves, but you also are in a position where you have to know Esther is in charge of the house of Haman, and therefore, by definition, Haman is out and Esther is in. And if Esther is in and Haman is out, then the second letter, which talks about the people of Esther, should be believed over the first letter, which talks about the people of Haman. I hope that makes sense. I hope that's logical. All right? But listen to this. Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra was a remarkable rabbi. Lived about 1,000 years ago. This week's parsha, Parshat Yitro, my favorite comment of Ibn Ezra. He says that it's a few weeks ago. It's in the 10 plagues. Talks about the plague of darkness. That's Parshat Bo, 2 weeks ago. And Ibn Ezra says, how do I describe the plague of darkness? So he says, I was once in the faraway islands. And I saw that for 5 days, I couldn't see my hand in front of my face. Where was he? He was in England, right? And in England, they used to have fogs, which literally, you know, you wear this London fog jacket, right? You have this company. The reality is that I remember as a kid, 1962, there was a called it a smog, because it was a mixture, because people still use coal fires. So you had the fog mixing with the smoke from the chimneys. I literally, when I was walking to school, and I only had a 5-minute walk, I was walking with my hands on the wall, walking down this road, not really being able to see my hand in front of my face. It was unbelievable. I'll never forget it. Why school wasn't cancelled is something that I can't explain. I don't remember now. They should have cancelled school. But they never did. In England, you know, you never had snow days, because really snow was not such a big deal. And smog days, whoever heard of them? But it was very bad. People with asthma and that sort of complaint, really, a lot of people died during that time. It was pretty serious. So that's my favourite. Ibn Ezra was in London round about the year 1100 and whatever, 1120, 1130, and he talks about the plague of darkness is like the smog, the terrible fog that he saw in England. And there is a suggestion that he's maybe buried somewhere in the UK. Right? We don't know where he is. He got to Cornwall, which is down south. He travelled around. He was in Oxford. That's already the university got going in that, around that period of time. So he may have well have had a connection in the university. Very, very unusual, interesting person. Never made money. He said he was the poorest rabbi he ever met. Right? He writes about his own situation. And fascinating, fascinating individual. Now listen to what he says here, because this is really something, it's something special. It's in the middle of the second column where there's an asterisk. Yesh lishok, he says, I want to ask the question. Lama katab Mordechai laharog sone yudim. Why did Mordechai tell in the second letter which was sent out that the Jews have to kill their enemies? V'rav lo, surely it will be enough. V'lahem, and for the Jews, sheyimotu, that they will escape. Enough. Just give them permission to run away and, you know, the enemy won't be able to kill them. Why were the Jews told to go and kill their enemies? He says, you should know, da. He says, I want to explain to you. Ki chacham gadol haya. Mordechai was a great chacham. He was really smart. V'hine, Achashverosh amar lo, so what did the king say to him? Asay kol ma shetuchal kedei lemaleit amecha. The king said, do everything you can to save your people. Ki asvarim arishonim shekatav Haman, the first letter written with the hand of Haman and sealed by the king, nichtavu bishmi, they were sealed in my name, v'nechtamu b'tabati, and they had my ring, the signet ring was on it, lo chalashivam, that letter stands, I can't do anything about it. Kikain dat modaya paras, that's the rule in this country, once the letter goes out, nothing I can do. V'ha'e b'divrei Daniel, and he brings a proof from the story of Daniel, when Daniel was thrown into the lion's den, they couldn't retract that decision, the king could not take it back, and he was thrown into the lion's den as a result. Again, this is the rules of Persia. But he says, listen to this. This is so interesting. He says, "V'inei hutzrach Mordechai lichtov ken." So let's speculate. What did Mordechai write in the second letter? Right? This is what I would do in school. I would hand out the paper, and I would get all the students to sit down and write what Mordechai would have written in the second letter, because he's got a problem. How does Mordechai get the people to believe the second letter more than the first? This is what he did. Fascinating. He says, the letter goes like this, and he's sort of making it up as he goes along, the Ibn Ezra, but it's very interesting. He says, the letter starts like this, dear brethren, or words to that effect, Da'u, you should know, Shehamelech tziva lahaman, when the king commanded Haman, Shehaya Mishneh LeMelech, who was the prime minister, Sheikhtov Ketav B'Shem HaMelech, that he should write a letter in the name of the king, V'notan lo HaMelech Tabato Lachdom Bo, and the king gave him his signet ring, Shehargu Ayudim Et Oyveihem, that the Jews now should kill their enemies, B'Shlosh Asar L'Chodesh Adar, on the 13th of Adar. In other words, the original letter Mordechai is going to claim, as being a little bit devious here, is that in fact the original letter said the king was allowing the Jews to kill their enemies. Completely the opposite of what it was. But what did Haman do? He just switched around. Instead of saying the Jews killed their enemies, he switched it around that the enemies killed the Jews. So Haman is the bad guy because he actually changed the command of the king. Now the king is sending a second letter saying what the original letter meant, which is not that the enemies kill the Jews, but that the Jews can kill their enemies. So the second letter now becomes the authentic, not only second letter, says the Ibn Ezra, but the first letter as well. Right? I'll say this again, because it's so interesting. He says, what could Mordechai write in the second letter to convince people that the first one was wrong. And he says the way it works is like this. Mordechai would have sent in his second letter the following message. The first letter came out from Haman. And you know what it really said? The king had commissioned a letter to go out that the Jews can kill their enemies. For reasons that the king had, who knows what the king was thinking. But what did Haman do with the first letter? He changed it around. He's the bad guy. He took the word Jews and enemies and changed it around that the enemies of the Jews can kill the Jews. Now, the second letter is coming, and Mordechai says the second letter he writes, this is what the king really meant to say. Not that the enemies can kill the Jews, but the Jews can kill their enemies. If that's the case, then with the second letter, he has essentially overcome the effect of the first letter. It's not cancelling the first letter. It's saying that the first letter which was sent in error. Because Haman changed the letter. Right? You have this sometimes, records. Right? The famous, I mean, we've all forgotten about it, all the thousands of emails that became very controversial in the election that we had not a long time ago. And the whole question of the authenticity of those emails. And that's a big deal today when you get that kind of information. How authentic, how reliable is it? And this is what is going on here. That with this second letter, it's basically saying that the first letter wasn't authentic. It was sent by Haman, but he was devious. And he was saying that the king gave permission for the enemy of the Jew to kill the Jew, when it really was the other way around. And Mordechai is now saying, this is what the first letter really said. So he's not really cancelling the first letter. He's explaining what the first letter was really meant to say. Very unbelievable. I mean, who would think of something? I know, I certainly would not come out with this, but Ibn Ezra says it's possible.
I've got a big problem with this.
Yeah.
Couldn't the second letter start out saying that this second letter circumvents the first
and that's,
letter
no.
you got?
No. No, because the first letter stands. The king's seal means that you have
but to
fulfill it.
Has a seal.
And it's a problem because you've got two letters standing in complete
so
contradiction.
Super
it doesn't, unless you can make it go over the head of the first one, and that's what Ibn Ezra says he did. By proving that the first one wasn't authentic. Why wasn't it authentic? Because the letter should have said Jews kill their enemies. And what it actually said, because Haman rewrote it, he had a scribe, one of his sons was a scribe, and instead of saying Jews kill their enemies, it said enemies kill the Jews. The Amalekites can kill the Jews. And that was Haman's way of manipulating the original story, and now Mordechai can send a second letter to go against the first letter and overcome it by proving that the first one was in fact a forgery. It should never have said what it said, because Haman, being the devious and wicked person that he was, changed the wording. But it was the wording that was wrong.
Fine. You'd say, this circumvents the first letter. Forget the first letter.
Yeah, yeah. You would expect that. But the problem is, in Persia, it didn't work like that. Once a letter has been established and gone out, you have to obey the what's written in the letter. And it seems a crazy system. It's crazy. You know, nowadays, we would have the second letter would clearly overshadow the first one if it comes, you know, eventually rise. But in Persia, you've got the problem that the first one has a certain amount of, you know, strength, and you can't just overturn it. So you've got to find some clever way for people to believe the second one as opposed to the first one. And of course, what Ibn Ezra is basically saying is that by suggesting that the first one was written in error, then the second one has to be believed. Right? And the first one is wrong. And with Rashi you can add, and how do you prove that the first one was written in error? Because Haman's property has gone to Esther. So if the king was supporting the Jews, killing their enemies, it makes sense. Why now the house of Haman becomes taken over by the Jewish queen. But if you want to suggest the first letter was that Haman was allowed, or rather the king was allowing the enemies of the Jews to kill the Jews, then why is the king giving Esther the house of Haman? It would be, again, a contradiction. So all the evidence is coming towards an appreciation, an awareness that the first letter that went out was sent out in some sort of error, some sort of mistake. And that's how you can go against it. But you can't just tear it up. I wish you could. That would be the obvious thing to do. Tear up letter number one, you got letter number two, and Shalom Yisrael, everything is easy. But it doesn't work like that. The Persian laws are really weird.
The king's word was cast in stone.
It was cast in stone. And therefore, in order to break it, you need a hammer and a chisel and everything else. You need one of these, what do they call it? You know, pneumatic drills in order to try and smash it into pieces. And the only way you can have a pneumatic drill in this case is by reconfigurating. All right, or what are we saying with computers? Rebooting. You'd have to reboot the whole letter in the first place, yeah, using the language of the 21st century. I just want to show you something here that what the Ralbag, just the next paragraph. Again, we're speculating, but I love this speculation because it just makes you think. Listen to the next paragraph, because what the Ralbag says is something fascinating. That the end of the day, the question was that why did Mordechai make the letter so aggressive, the second letter, to attack the enemy? And the basic bottom line is that this is what we need to know. That when we are in a situation in Galut, when we're not in our own country, and the enemy rises up against us, then to just say, we'll bury our head in the... I mean, it's got echoes, of frightening echoes. Burying our head in the sand, and it's all going to go away, that's not the way to deal with it. I read a story this week, someone in Brooklyn who is really, really getting very, very upset. He was something called Dov Hikin, who was a politician in Brooklyn, from guy, who had an approach this week from a young man who was screamed at on the subway, anti-Semitic abuse at this young guy. And he didn't know what to do. He was scared to respond to this crazy person screaming at him because he thought that, you know, he may have a weapon on him and who knows what this lunatic is going to do. But he went to Hikin and Hikin said, did you take, you know, any sort of picture of the man or any? Can you re-describe who he was? Go to the police. Don't remotely accept the fact that people can just scream this abuse at you without doing anything in response. Because we've been there. We know what happens. Menachem Begin said he was phenomenal. Of all the prime ministers, he's the one that, you know, you just have to read his stuff over and over again. He said the one thing we learn from the Holocaust is when they say that they're going to do it, they mean it. Right? Not that we should bury our heads in the sand and say, "Well, it's all going to go away. It's never going to be a problem. It's always going to blow over," as they say. It doesn't blow over. It doesn't go away. And if we don't pick up ourselves and do something about this, is why the story of Purim is so timely, that we will again commit the sin, which is a sin which we commit very often, of not learning from history. We just don't learn. We don't get it. We don't understand that there comes a point when we are in a position of being attacked for whatever purpose, and we've had enough proof of this in the last year or two. I mean, so frightening. And we as a community, and thank God people are responding. And the bracha, we're living in such a wonderful country, a country of chesed. People are defending us. The police are there for us. And the reality is that that is an incredible thing. In 1938, the country was not there for the Jewish people. On the contrary, they lit the fires. You know, Kristallnacht was part and parcel of the German police force as much as anybody else. They lit the fires along with everybody. They didn't defend the Jews at all. So we are very much in a position where we should not accept these things, and we learn from Mordechai. Mordechai's comment in his letter that he sent out was very simple. And I'll read it to you. It's actually on the page. A better interpretation is the Maharal. It's the second from last paragraph on the left-hand side. And I'll just read this because it's so relevant. Ki Yisrael kishehem begalut, bein ha'amim, when the Jews are in exile, yesh sham sonei lehem, if there is someone who is announced that he's anti-Semitic, hu mizera amalek. No question, this is an Amalekite. It wasn't just enough to try and cancel all of the original letters that went out. Go back to where you were before Haman came along, as if nothing had happened. No. The reality is, we're commanded to deal with Amalek. To wipe Amalek. The whole existence from the world. Shaul HaMelech ne'evan b'malchuto. Shaul HaMelech failed. He lost his kingship. B'shvil shenatan la'malek pleita, because he allowed the Malek to escape. V'ata yu notnim la'malek pleita kasher naflu li'adam. And now, would Amalek be able to escape again if the Jews were not commanded to go and take an offensive position against them? So therefore, Torah Amra, the Torah says, Ketov Zod Zikaron Basefer. This is what we're going to read in a few weeks' time. Actually, no, we read it last week in Parshat Bashalah, the actual story of Amalek. Write it down in a book. And the rabbi said, Katuv Ramaz Gamkein Amasa Megillah Zon. What is the Sefer? What is the book that has to deal with Amalek? The book of the Megillah. That's one of the references in the Torah to a future book that's going to be written, the book of the Megillah of Esther. And therefore, Shehu Limchot Shemo Min Olam, it's telling us, Amalek, you don't compromise. When it comes to the anti-Semite, there's no compromise. And unfortunately, what the tragedy is, how a whole generation, particularly in the Palestinian community, is being brought up with that sense of the Jew doesn't deserve to live, the state of Israel doesn't deserve to exist. It's scary. It's frightening. And I don't know if there'll ever be a way of making peace with those people. I just don't know. Unless the whole mindset changes and they decide that their educational system, because it starts really from kindergarten, the indoctrination that's going on there, and we can read all about this online, you can see it all, it's all there to be seen. And the reality of it is that we have to understand when it comes to Amalek, no compromises. Just turn over one thing, because I'm just running out of time, and I just want to turn over to the other side of the page and just show you the whole thing about the conversions. Interesting thing here, which is that what happened with these conversions, that the end of the chapter said, and it's got the pasuk at the top of the page, ובכל מדינה מדינה, בכל עיר ועיר, מקום אשר דבר מלך ודתו מגיע, שמחה וססון ליהודים. We know that there was great rejoicing for the Jews. מישתה ויונטוב, רבים מעמי הארץ מתייהדים. And many of the people around them started converting to become Jewish. כי נפל פחד היהודים עליהם, they did it out of fear. And the question is, can you accept a convert out of fear? Says the commentary here, Rashi says, what does mityahadim mean? Mitgairim. They were trying to convert. And here he quotes from the Midrash. I'm going to miss out the Midrash just one second. The where it's underlined after that next paragraph where it says ulam, about 10 lines down. Ulam be'enei halacha, when it comes to the question of Jewish law, Lo nirata higayrut zo yafe. The conversion was not acceptable. The enemy could not convert. Ki ach mipnei pachad ayudim idyadu. The whole reason why they wanted to convert was out of fear, and that's not a good reason. Right? Interesting story about 40 years ago. Just got married, I think we were married 2 years. Got a phone call from the London Bet Din. And the phone call was from Madayan Swift. His brother used to be the rabbi in Englewood. Those who come from Englewood, Isaac Swift. Had a brother in London who was a dayan on the Bet Din in London. And he called up and he said, there's this young man who's converting to become Jewish. He needs to live with a Jewish family. And we heard through the grapevine that, you know, we were advertising a room. We needed someone to come in and lodge or whatever. And can he come and visit you? Can he come and see you to become your, you know, to live with you with a Jewish family for 6 months? And he turned up at the door and whatever. I'd never seen a more Aryan looking guy in my life. Right, long hair, which was blonde, blue eyes, and he came with a big bunch of flowers, very interesting guy, and he was genuine. He really was the real deal. Just to go to the end of the story, he did convert, became the president of his shul. I met him many years later, and the long hair had gone. I have to say, you know, he was now sort of very conventional, and really was a big success. But the issue that I called the London Bet Din, I said, do you know that the reason why he's converting, he's got a Jewish girlfriend. And if he's converting for reasons of being in love with a Jewish girl, do you accept such a convert? And I knew the answer was going to be no. So they called back and they said, we know about the girlfriend and we know about the relationship, but we believe that he is sincere. It's fascinating. They really got it right. And the bottom line was that he did marry her. He became much frummer than she was, I have to say. Boy, you know, this guy was, as I said, he became president of the shul, and if you do that, you know, you're really making a commitment. An Orthodox synagogue, and they had, I think, 4 or 5 children. It's a very big success story of a conversion from many years ago with this proviso, and this is why I tell you the story, because of what we're saying here. If there's an ulterior motive to convert, it's not always acceptable as a reason for conversion. And very often today, part of the ulterior motive that the many Bote Din, Jewish courts, do not like, is if there's a Jewish girlfriend involved, or Jewish boyfriend. And this is, again, something which relates over here. This is now talking about the Purim story. It wasn't about boyfriends and girlfriends in those days, but it was about being afraid of the Jews. So listen to this little item here, and then we'll be done. Mit Yahadim, it's halfway down. Mit Yahadim, Osu Atzmam Yudim. They started walking around as if they were Jewish. They, as nowadays you would say, they put on all the clothing. Avo be'emet lo kiblu otam, but they weren't really Jewish. So according, this is the commentary of the Vilna Gaon. According to his interpretation, those people who tried to convert were not accepted. You don't have them, they don't get an aliyah and shul, they're not considered to be Jewish. It doesn't say whether they went through the Brit, you know, I suspect they probably didn't. This was an attempt to try and save their necks. And he says, Mikam, this is another comment from a Hasidic Rebbe, who says, Aminag litchapes b'Purim. That's why we have the custom to dress up on Purim, because we're hiding our real identity, as did those people tried to hide the fact that they were not Jewish, and they tried to dress up as Jews. Interesting. And he goes on, Shehoi Rab Nechemya Omer, this is a quote from Gemara, that Rabbi Chemna says, Echa geri aroyos, vecha geri chalomos, vecha geri Mordechai v'Esther, inom gerim. The Gemara has a whole discussion, can you accept converts on the basis of certain situations, like in the days of Mordechai and Esther? And the answer is, says the Gemara, according to one opinion, no. However, the Gemara then says, Halacha k'divra Omer kulam gerim. Another opinion says, yes. Make up your mind, rabbis. Yes or no? Tana Rabbanan, it goes on. What's going to be when Mashiach comes? Can everybody become Jewish? Interesting question, right? The reality was, go back in history, when David was the king and Solomon was the king, converts were not easily accepted, if at all, because the Jews had a very high status. The country was very wealthy. The same question may be even today. Israel's economy is doing so much better than many other countries in the world. Is the Bet Din in Israel allowed to say you're not accepted as a convert because you're only here to better your economic status? In other words, it's not sincere, your conversion. I wonder if that happens today. I won't be surprised if it does. And it goes on, this is a whole Gemara. And the Gemara then says, Amar Rabbi Eliezer, my Quran, it goes through a Pasuk, and there's a whole discussion, even at the bottom here, whether you can accept converts even from Amalek, right? There is this whole discussion whether even Amalekites can even convert, and it's a big question. There's a famous Gemara. The Gemara says that the grandchildren of Haman studied Torah in Bnei Brak. So the rabbis say, there you go. The proof is that his grandchildren or his descendants became Jewish. Well, what? Why would anyone live in Bnei Brak if you're not Jewish, for goodness sake? If you've ever been there, you know what I mean. Very schwitzy place. But the reality is, you know what? They became Jewish. Says one of the rabbis, no. It doesn't say Haman. It says another character called Naaman, a completely different person. So even the rabbis, in the end, are very conflicted whether you can accept converts under this circumstance. Very interesting, right? So when you hear a rabbi having issues with conversions, it's not so straightforward. Right, and you have to look at the motivation, and you have to look at the background, and the whole parsha onto itself. I just want to say two things. The final comment in section D, we spoke about last week, that when the Jews were allowed to take their revenge and attack their enemy, they didn't take any spoils. It's fascinating. They were allowed to, and they didn't. They didn't want the people around them to see that they, or make an assumption that the Jews are doing it, as they say, for the money. They weren't doing it for the money. This was pure commitment to what Mordechai and Esther had sent as a second letter, which is that you have to go and essentially rid the world of what Amalek represents. And it's pretty amazing what happened. What I'm going to leave you with to think about, because we're coming to the end of our time, and we'll talk about this next week, is the way that the holiday actually became established. Two interesting things. Number one, did the rabbis want to make a holiday of Purim? Did they really want to make the holiday? Right? When you look at the Gemara, you'll see that Esther had a big fight. She goes to the rabbis and she says, Rabbosai, I want to write the book of Purim. I want to write the story down. So they said, no, you mustn't do that. So she said, why? Because they said it'll bring anti-Semitism. All the anti-Semites will read this story in the future and they will go and attack the Jews because, you know, they see this story and they get crazy. So she said, "Rabbis, you're kidding yourselves. It's written down in the Persian chronicle anyway. And it's written down in the chronicles of Media and Persia and all the other places. So what are we kidding ourselves? Let's at least get an authentic version of the story written down so that when people read it, not to read their version, which can always be corrupted, but we'll have our authentic version of events." And the rabbis gave in. And it's fascinating. We'll talk about this, Mitzvah Shem, next week. The whole issue of the acceptance of the holiday of Purim. How did it get accepted? And it was a big fight. And Esther won in the end, but I suspect there was another issue there of, as we said, according to Rabbi Lau, her whole background. Now she's the queen and she goes to the rabbis. You know what they're going to say? We're not really sure about this woman. She's taken on, you know, maybe she's got an ulterior motive here for wanting us to write this down. Maybe she's been influenced by Ahasuerus because she's living with him. The big issue at the end of the book, and this is something which we'll get to maybe in a couple of weeks, and again, I'm just throwing out the questions, I want you to think about this, is the question of Esther Mordechai after the whole story. Mordechai, what happened to him? And more of a problem, what happened to Esther? Did Esther Mordechai go from the story of Purim and disappear into the Jewish ghetto, never to be seen again, right? And they lived happily ever after. Or did Esther actually not do that? And Mordechai not do that. And it's an amazing end of what happens here. And there is, you know, 10 chapters of the Megillah, we're actually going to talk about chapter 11. Because chapter 11 of the Megillah is really the most controversial chapter of the whole Megillah. It really opens up our eyes to something which, in school, I don't think we'd be allowed to talk about this. I really am sure I'd be told not to discuss it. I noticed the art scroll, interestingly, just brought out a book. It's just on the bookshelf over here. Introduction to Talmud. 300-page introduction. And in passing, they mention about Esther and Ahasuerus, that they had a child. They mention this in the book, and they don't give any notes. And everybody, to me, would read that. If you're coming from the world of art scroll, where everything seems to be very controlled Judaism, as I call it, somebody said to me, a bit naive as well, They mention a fact which really should get people very upset. What do you mean Esther and Ahasuerus had a child? We'll find out about that. They really did. And not only that, it's very significant in the whole story after the events of Purim. But we'll come to that Mitzvah Shem next week. I also want you to think about the whole way that the holiday becomes celebrated. We have parties, Purim parties, very nice. But what's this matanot levyonim? Mishloach, manot, making sure people have food, people have money. What's going on? Right? It seems to be something very unique to Purim. What is that all about? I know that we can celebrate and we'll get drunk if we like getting drunk and maybe you do it once, you never do it again. All that stuff. But what's this giving of food? What is that all about? How did that become so much integrated into the whole celebration of Purim? So very quickly, what we did today, I just want to review. We said that in terms of the question that we asked about the letters, how did the second letter gain traction? The answer is maybe that it was explained that the first letter was actually false. In terms of Ibn Ezra tries to give that interpretation, it was really wrong. Haman adopted the first letter, so the second letter was the original text of the first letter. Whichever way you want to understand it. We did talk a little bit about the idea of dealing with the Amalekite in the Galut, in the exile, which is always a big challenge. How do we deal with anti-Semitism in the 21st century? Very difficult question that we have to come up and deal with it again. And it's tragic that we have to deal with this. And it's never going to go away. And then the whole question of conversions, and were these conversions accepted or not accepted? You see, the Gemara is conflicted about it. And the interesting thing at the end, which we mentioned about the spoils, the Jews did not do it for the money. No spoils were taken. What we will do next week, Bezrat Hashem, we'll learn chapter 9. We'll begin the discussion about how the holiday developed, how it came about, and try to deal with some of the fallout. As I said, by the end of the story, what really happened next. Right? And Bezrat Hashem, you know, we're getting to the end, but there's still what to say. Thank you for listening, everybody. Thank you so much. Thank you.